Hello and welcome to all my fellow tender testudinese darlings. I'm your host, Meredith Meeker, and this is another episode of How Do I Do This? An Environmental Career Podcast. My Latin isn't very good, but I did Google how to say testudinese, so I hope I'm not messing it up too much. And that's the family that turtles fall into. And today I'm grateful for the fact that turtles did not go the way of the dinosaur, and that on a sunny day, maybe out in a canoe, you can still spot these creatures. And this week's guest is a turtle expert and Guinness World Record holder, but I'll let him tell you about that. David Seaburn is a freshwater turtle specialist with the Canadian Wildlife Federation. He is working hard on the ground to save these beautiful and sometimes misunderstood creatures. In 2020, he was presented with the Blue Racer Award from the Canadian Herpetological Society for the significant contribution to the conservation of amphibians and reptiles. So, pretty impressive. Let's get into it. So, David, thank you so much for being here with us today. I like to start things off by getting a sense of where you like to get outdoors and explore. Do you have a favorite place you go to connect with nature?
That's a hard question because there's a lot of places I like to disappear into. But if I had to pick one for really recharging my batteries, it would definitely be Algonquin Park. The Highway 60 corridor is a pretty busy area, but if you bring your canoe, and you can have a couple of days to canoe in towards the center of the park, all of a sudden you've been transported to a different world. It's very, very quiet. You can no longer hear the road, and you may spend a day or two without seeing other people, which is a very rare experience in our world. So that's definitely one of my favorite places. And my wife and I try to get off to Algonquin for a backcountry trip every year.
That's awesome. I've been on a couple backcountry trips in Algonquin, and it's such a beautiful place, and we're very lucky to have it fairly accessible to us in southern Ontario.
Indeed, and I'm in the Ottawa area, so it's even closer for me probably.
Oh yes, very nice. So as a freshwater turtle specialist, what is it, you know, that you do, and why is it so important to conservation?
That's a big question. I'm gonna step back a little bit and assume your listeners don't know a lot about turtles. And so as a group, turtles have been around for over 200 million years, which is a pretty mind-blowing concept. So turtles walked the earth with dinosaurs. Dinosaurs went extinct, but turtles survived. So we know these are tough critters. They've been around a long time. But unfortunately, their natural history life cycle is no longer working for them. It's working against them in the modern world. So in Canada, we have 8 species of freshwater turtles. And all of them, all 8 species, are now listed as species at risk by the federal government. And so this makes turtles one of the most endangered groups of species in Canada. That's something that most people, and even most biologists, don't know. So turtles need a lot of help, and they face a number of threats. 3 of the major threats they face are habitat loss. It's, you know, a common threat for many species. Roadkill is a severe threat for many species of turtles. And some species, as we know, have adapted well to humans, and things like raccoons have done quite well. And raccoons are nest predators, so they eat turtle eggs. So we have increased raccoon populations and therefore decreased reproductive success. So our work at the Canadian Wildlife Federation is trying to focus in on all 3 of these major threats and trying to address them. So, for example, the Blanding's turtle is a provincially threatened species. It's also a nationally threatened species, and it's also a globally endangered species, which is something, again, a lot of people don't know, that we have globally endangered species in our province. In any case, under the Provincial Endangered Species Act, the Blanding's turtle receives habitat protection. So if we can find locations that are previously unknown and document the species in that wetland, we can provide extra habitat protection to that wetland in adjacent wetlands. And so that's one of the things we've been doing the last few years, is going into wetlands and hunting for Blanding's turtles. And as a result of our efforts, we've now protected approximately 90 square kilometers of wetland habitat. So that's protecting it for the Blanding's, which is, you know, this beautiful turtle with the bright yellow throat, but it's also protecting it for the plants, the insects, the mammals, the amphibians that call home in those wetlands. So we can't save these species unless we protect their habitat. So one, we're actively protecting habitat. Number two, roadkill. We've been doing surveys along major roads in Eastern Ontario for the past few years, and we have so far found over 1,600 dead turtles on the road. So I'm going to say that again, 1,600 dead turtles. That's a staggering amount of roadkill, and it's almost certainly not sustainable. So from this rich database we now have, we can target areas where we find turtles on the road commonly. So these are hotspots where turtles are crossing the road and being killed. And then we can take that information about where the hotspots are and figure out how to reduce roadkill in those spots. And so far, we have managed to work with the provincial government to have wildlife fencing installed at two of our major hotspots in Eastern Ontario. And we surveyed those two hotspots in 2020 after the wildlife fencing went up, and we had no roadkill whatsoever. So it was a complete success story. So wildlife mitigation fencing is basically just fencing that keeps the turtles off the road, keeps other species off the road as well. But also we want to make sure that those areas have crossing structures under the road. So we target areas that have drainage culverts under the road, because those can be crossing structures as well. And that's been well documented in the scientific literature. So far, we've got two road mitigation projects that have been installed. And we have a third one going in before spring of this year. And we've got two more sites that we're hoping to get wildlife mitigation installed in the next couple of years. So it's a slow process, but we're trying to, you know, reduce roadkill literally on the ground, on the roads. The third thing that we're working on is trying to improve reproductive success for turtle populations. So we've developed nest protectors that can go on nests and keep the raccoons out, would like to get in there and eat the eggs. That works great for sites around wetlands and things like that. But a lot of turtles, unfortunately, like to nest along roadsides. And nest protectors typically can't be installed there. They're a safety risk or a hazard to motorists and cars pulling off the road. So for those occasions, we actually go in and we collect the eggs, bring them back to our lab, we incubate them, have the hatchlings come out, and then we take the hatchlings back to where the nest was and release them at the nearest wetland to that site. And over the past few years, we've now released over 1,400 hatchlings. Now, I need to stress that this is not making up for all the turtles killed on the roads, because typically a lot of those are adults or large juveniles. And we know hatchlings also have high mortality, but we are compensating a little bit and making a small improvement to the future populations for these turtles. So those are three major things that we're trying to do every year.
Well, it sounds like through a combination of those three things, you know, you are going to see an impact on the ground. I mean, you already are with those crossings. I think it's amazing that you can see that they are successful within the year that they're installed. Like that's very impressive. And as someone who has had the privilege to see baby Blanding's turtles hatchlings, they are the cutest things, like little smiling dinosaurs, basically. So I think it's very cool what you're doing.
No, oh, thank you. I mean, it's nice to make a difference on the ground. So often we write reports, we give recommendations, but the connection between that and conservation on the ground can sometimes be rather tenuous.
Mm-hmm. And maybe can you tell us about the journey and how you got to where you are now, where you are making a difference on the ground and working with the Canadian Wildlife Federation?
Sure. I think most people will tell you that their life path or their career path is typically not a straight line. Mine's been very, very circuitous. As an undergraduate student in university, if you were to walk up to me and say, Dave, someday you're going to be an expert in turtles, I would have just laughed at you. It was not conceivably on my radar. But I was interested in the environmental field, biodiversity issues, biodiversity loss, but I had no idea where my particular niche was. So I ended up academically taking courses all over the place, managing to get a degree in geography. And after that, around in various odd jobs from construction to different things, eventually went back to school, got a master's degree in disturbance ecology, but completely unrelated to amphibians, reptiles, turtles, herpetology, the broad study of amphibians and reptiles. But looking at how we're messing up the environment and how we can respond to those issues. So it was good training. And then my lovely wife did a master's degree on the five-line skink, which is Ontario's only lizard. And eventually the two of us were having difficulties finding jobs during one of the economic downturns after we both graduated. And we decided with great ambition, naivety, to start a small consulting company. And we did work on species at risk. It was just the two of us with letterhead, not much else. We managed to do that for quite a few years, working on species at risk issues. Eventually, we realized it was getting harder and harder to make a go of it financially. She ended up getting a job with the federal government as a species at risk biologist. I continued as a consultant for a few more years. And eventually, I think I worked as a consultant for about 20 years. And had done some work with the Canadian Wildlife Federation. They were starting up a turtle project and were looking for someone to run the project. And so I expressed interest in, with 20 years background in species at risk and amphibian and reptile background, I had extensive background in writing proposals, doing the field work, hiring people, balancing budgets, et cetera, and of course, having a broad national network. So they were happy to have me come on board, and I've been there since 2017 and absolutely love my job and where I work.
That's awesome. I'm curious, how does working for Canadian Wildlife Federation differ from working in consulting?
That's a good question. There's a lot of differences. The main one is there's a team involved, because as a consultant, I was typically working with myself or just with my partner. So it's very wonderful to have the expertise in the office, and you can, well, pre-COVID days at least, you could walk down the hall and talk to someone and run ideas and bounce ideas off them. And there's all kinds of institutional advantages when it comes to fundraising. If an NGO can say, we will provide this as matching funds in terms of logistical support or a vehicle or office space or computer equipment or GIS specialist, it really helps the fundraising to be able to find those matching funds. To be honest, it's also very nice to have a steady paycheck. So as a consultant, basically, you're always unemployed and looking for your next job. And I did that for 20 years. And it gets to be a major drag when you can no longer have, you can't plan long-term projects because there just isn't funding for it. So having a project built inside an NGO, you can plan out for this year, next year, and perhaps a third year down the road as how things will expand out. And that's very nice and very rare these days.
Mm-hmm. Must be also very satisfying to be able to see a multi-year project from the beginning to the end. I think that's...
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. It's a place where I get a lot of my job satisfaction. I like to see things from start to finish. But do you have any advice that you wish somebody had told you, or you wish you could give somebody who was just starting out their career?
Definitely. One thing I would pass on to my younger self would be to develop more specialized skills. So anyone who can identify bird calls, can identify plants, is going to be have more jobs come open for them. Those may just be summer jobs, but those are often the first, you know, the first step on your career. So it's the people that have not necessarily rare skills, but more specialized skills. That really helps. I also think, and that can apply to technical skills too. So if you have very good GIS skills, that's an excellent skill to have on your resume. I also think I would have told my younger self to take more chances. Sometimes you get an opportunity. Hey, do you want to volunteer in this project? It'll take 2 months. You can't make any money that summer, but it'll be fun. It'll look good on your resume. And you go, yeah, but maybe I should get this other job where I'm doing something boring, but I'll have money and I can pay my tuition. And I think typically I regret not taking those chances, because those are the things you look back on in fondness, not your summer working in a restaurant, unless that's your passion in life. And third, it's really important to develop your network. I'm a bit of an introvert. That's hard for me to do, but it is so important, because so many jobs get filled by word of mouth. And so I'm looking for someone who's not an entry-level position. I call people I know and they say, yeah, I can recommend someone. She just finished her master's degree. She's fantastic. She's smart and she's easy to work with. Bam. We're probably 90% done the hiring process at that point. So if you're not part of these networks, you're overlooked.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure going through your network also saves you a lot of time. And you get a quality candidate.
Exactly. I mean, it's an unfortunate problem, but people don't like going through resumes because there's just so many of them and it's a difficult process. We do go through resumes for entry-level jobs, but for a lot of positions, it's not just who you know, but it's being good and who you know. So right. I'm not going to hire someone because I know you, but if you're good and I know you, that does increase your odds.
Right. And so maybe if you have those specialized skills, then that also, you know, will translate and your network will know about it. Now, do you have a favorite project that you've worked on over your, I guess, 20 years plus career?
My current job is my favorite project just because it's so amazing. But I'm going to pick a different one just to talk about something other than turtles. So a few years back, one of my volunteer hats was being on the steering committee for the Ontario Reptile and Amphibian Atlas. It's kind of like the Bird Atlas, but for amphibians and reptiles, obviously. And it's the second HERP Atlas, just like it's currently the second, oh, actually the third Bird Atlas, I guess, it's just started up. And so we could compare our data with the first year. And we noticed that there were a lot fewer observations of redback salamanders, a really common widespread species in a large part of Ontario. So people were saying, gosh, salamanders must have really declined. This is pretty unfortunate. And I was saying, well, maybe they've declined, but you know, maybe this is just because people have to actively hunt for salamanders. And so maybe they're just underreported, not vanished. So I was intrigued enough that I managed to track down some funding for the project. And a colleague and I spent a week hunting for salamanders in areas where there were historic records, but no recent records. And what did we find? We found redback salamanders in over 80% of those areas. So clearly they had not declined. And so we wrote this up. We got a scientific paper out of it as well. But it was a very powerful example of how you're doing a volunteer project. You see a question, you're not convinced about the obvious answer. You figure out how to test it. You figure out how to finance the project, you carry it out, and then you find out that, whoa, maybe they haven't declined, but people just are not reporting them. So it underscores the importance of citizen science data, but also the limitations of citizen science data and how we have to always be cautious in how we interpret the data we have.
Do you think that there's, because it's over such a large time span, that there's been a loss of knowledge in how to find salamanders? Or do you think it's just a coincidence that between the years people were less likely to see them?
That's hard to speculate on. We know that we were in some provincial parks, including Algonquin Park, and found salamanders in areas where there had been no reports in 20 years. So there have been lots of naturalists in those areas, but you have to have someone looking for the species and then reporting it as well. So there's the two elements. I don't think the skill has been lost. It could just be that if you have 100 people looking for salamanders, they report them, but they may not go back to the same area 20 years later. So those areas don't get surveyed because that person has moved on or is no longer interested.
Right, right. So that's one of your favorite projects, but maybe what's the best part of your overall job?
Right now, I'd say it is a day in the middle of August when the eggs begin to hatch. And so typically it begins with one of the summer staff going in to check on the incubators and comes running out and screaming, "The eggs! They're hatching! They're hatching!" And it, pre-COVID again, it's the best day in the office. And we have everyone rushing in to see the eggs beginning to hatch and the first hatchlings crawling out of their shells. And it's a magical moment because, you know, this is the first moment that this living creature has seen the world. They've been inside this tiny eggshell. They poke their head out. They're looking around. And you realize that it's your efforts that are responsible for this creature even being alive, because likely it would have been eaten by a raccoon as an egg. So that is deeply gratifying. And it's also amazing to then, when they're ready, release them back into the wild and let them go on their way and wish them well and wish them a long life.
That sounds like something that would never get old.
Definitely not. Every year it's a thrill.
I guess on the flip side of that, you know, it would be very easy to find your dream job or your dream career if everything was just turtle hatching days, but maybe what's the most challenging or unexpected part of your job?
Well, I can tell you that roadkill is definitely a difficult thing to handle. And as I said before, we now have 1,600 dead turtles. So driving around and finding hundreds and hundreds of dead turtles is very difficult to handle. And it can be very, very demoralizing on a bad day when you find 30 or more dead turtles on the road. You kind of come home and just feel very, very depressed and helpless that you're not able to do enough. So there's that kind of emotional side to the work. On the more prosaic side, budgeting, administration, fundraising, these are all important things, but they are painstaking and difficult, and trying to patch together three or four different fundraising grants and hoping you get enough from each of them to hire someone on to help do the work is a major headache and takes a lot of time. But it is an important part of the job as well, because in one sense, it's kind of like evolution in action, right? We're all competing for funds, and it's survival of the fittest, right? Or you hope at least the best proposals get funded, not just the ones with cute species in them. But it is always a challenge to figure out how you're going to pay for things and get things done.
I do think that's interesting, your first point, how unexpectedly emotional this job can be. And I think it's because we get into it because we're so passionate about the environment, and yet sometimes you're exposed to some of, I don't want to say the darker sides, but perhaps some of the more troubling environmental issues, and it can have a real toll. And yes, funding never ends. So I feel like people need to be prepared for that as well.
Yes. I mean, it's a question we ask all our interviewees is, you know, are you okay with dealing with and handling dead turtles and dragging them off the road so you can identify the species and measure it and determine whether it's a male or female? It's not something everyone wants to do, even if they really love animals. And I fully get that. It can be traumatizing.
I guess maybe on that note, do you have any advice for somebody who would want to apply and make their application stand out?
Yeah, so that's a big question. I've gone through hundreds and hundreds of resumes. And you see a lot of resumes which says, I'm a student and I've worked retail. And there's nothing else in that resume. And it's very difficult to stand out if that's all your resume says. So I'm also very, very sympathetic to the whole notion that, you know, I need a job to get experience, and I can't get experience without a job. There's a lot of truth to that. But at the same time, there's lots of things an individual can do either to make their resume stand out, or more meaningfully, to put more meaningful things into your resume. And that may not be a 5-minute task. That is doing things so that you can put them into your resume. So I'll give you some examples. It's important to volunteer. And so most people living in cities, there's probably a field naturalist club nearby. I encourage people to join their field naturalist club, but don't stop there. Join a committee. All these clubs are run by volunteers, and they need new blood, let's face it. So join a committee or two and do something on that committee, a defined project. Look for something that could be done that isn't being done. Oh, I see the club doesn't have a Twitter account. How about I set it up for you and run it for the next 6 months? Doesn't have to be an hour-long daily activity, but, you know, tweet things on the club's Twitter account. It could be, hey, I noticed the club's got a brochure on the birds of Kitchener, but nothing on butterflies. What about we do a brochure on the butterflies of Kitchener? Take it on, produce the task, finish it off, and then you can add it to your resume. If you can't volunteer at a field naturalist club, there's all kinds of other environmental groups, Canadian Wildlife Federation, Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society, Ontario Nature. A lot of these groups make use of volunteers. And it's important when you're volunteering that to give your time, but figure out that you're going to get something out of it too. If they just want you to lick envelopes, then, you know, think about whether that's valuable or not for your time. And I think some people think volunteering is just a way to get your foot in the door, and then I'm past it, and then I'll, you know, have my perfect job and we're done. But I fundamentally disagree. I think, especially in conservation, volunteering is a core part of how we get things done. So just as an example, I'll rattle off some of the things I do as a volunteer. And so I'm in my 50s. I'm not looking to get a new job or starting off, but this is what people do. And most of my friends would be in the same boat. So I belong to my local field naturalist club, and I sit on two of their committees. I'm, as I mentioned before, on the steering committee for the Ontario Reptile Amphibian Atlas. That occupies some of my time. I'm also the chair of the conservation committee for a national organization. That takes some of my time. I'm an associate editor for a scientific journal. That takes more of my time. And these are not things I do as part of my job. They get done in the evenings, they get done on the weekends, but it's how things get done. If you care about this field, you need to contribute back, and it's not just 9 to 5. It is beyond that. And the volunteering work can be very, very satisfying, and it's how a lot of stuff gets done that would never get done otherwise. So volunteer, that's number one. Number two, now this is especially for people who are looking for a field job, because there's all kinds of jobs out there. Maybe you want a job in policy, and it's going to be an office job, so different things go on the resume for that. But if I'm hiring someone to be a summer field tech, the most important question I want answered is, how is this person going to cope when it's pouring rain and the mosquitoes are wicked? Are they going to collapse and go sit back in the car? Well, they're not much use to me. But that's a hard thing to document in your resume. There typically isn't a section, you know, tolerance to mosquitoes in a resume. But people really need to think about resumes. You can put in the resume what you think is important. And I think too often the people that teach resume skills are office workers. You know, they're good people, but they're not thinking about field biologists. So they tell you to put in your education and your job experience, and that's it. Well, I say don't listen to them. Put that stuff in, but put in other things. So, for example, if you do go backcountry canoe camping or backcountry camping, put it in your resume, because it documents field skills. And to me, that's important, because probably everyone else in the pile already is saying, I'm a biology student. Okay, so you know the difference between a rock and a turtle. That's great. And you know some biology. That's great. We've established that. Now we're looking for, you know, details beyond it. So any kind of skills like that are fantastic. So I would put in, you know, backcountry camping, canoeing, using a compass, using a GPS. Those things help the person looking at the resume to see, aha, this person likes being outdoors. Because just because someone says, I love birds, I love dragonflies, doesn't mean they really like being outdoors. And they may actually freeze up when it comes to, you know, mosquitoes and things like that. So any kind of field skills you've got, put them in there. I also recommend to anyone, again, for field jobs, if you're interested in getting a summer tech position, a summer technician, if you're not an iNaturalist, you should be. Or eBird, if birds are your only interest. But if you're just interested in birds, you know, that's going to close down jobs to you. So I think iNaturalist is incredibly powerful. So for those not familiar with it, it's a citizen science platform. You can download the app for your phone. It's free. And you can document wildlife observations. So take a picture or now audio recordings, like for frogs and things like that, or birds. And you can post it to the website. And then others can confirm your observation. So in your resume, you can add a line. I have been on iNaturalist, and I have over 300 observations of 100 species. That tells me something. That tells me you're not just sitting on the couch watching Netflix. You're getting outside, and you're taking the initiative to observe things. You don't need a job to do that. You can do it. You know, winter's not the best time right now, but once it's spring, there's insects everywhere, there's plants. Don't do the plants in your garden unless they're native species. But, you know, any park you're going to, there are going to be insects. There are going to be plants. Those are things you can add to iNaturalist. I recommend it to everyone trying to prove they're interested. And that's what I'm looking for, is that there's the interest in the field. One last thing I'll add to that list is something called the Canadian Conservation Corps. So it's a program funded by the federal government, and it's run by my employer, the Canadian Wildlife Federation. And it's an opportunity for young people to get more training and more work experience. So if you're interested, check it out. You do not have to have graduated from university or college. You can be a college dropout, that's fine. But they will give you wilderness training, wilderness experience, perhaps sea kayaking off the coast of BC or backpacking in the Rockies. And then they give you a 2-month placement at a conservation organization where you're actually getting a job. You don't get paid for it, but they do cover all your expenses. So travel, food, and accommodation. So likely they're actually paying you more than you would with the minimum wage job, to be honest. So check that out. And I highly recommend people consider that as an option. We've had Conservation Corps interns the last 2 years on my particular project. They've all been phenomenal people, and I expect to have more Conservation Corps interns in our project this coming summer, COVID allowing.
Yes, actually the last season we were talking to a Conservation Corps participant, though her placement had been delayed because of COVID, so hopefully this year she'll be able to do that. And the other thing I was going to add about iNaturalist is you can even participate in other people's projects on it. And that would be a great way to show your interest. I know out in Mississauga, Conservation Authority, Credit Valley Conservation, they host a butterfly atlas. And you can participate in the project like that. So you can use it for many different ways. And yes, I highly recommend it. When I discovered it, I was like, oh, this is so cool. Someone can tell me what this bug is.
Yes, exactly. That's one of the reasons I love it, because I love insects, but my knowledge is not great. So if I find a strange looking beetle, I take a photograph, post it to iNat, and typically within 24 hours, someone has ID'd it down to the genus, if not the species, which is wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So moving a little bit more away from career stuff, you've been backcountry camping, you've got a very cool job with wildlife. So this might be another tricky question for you. But do you have a favorite nature moment? We call it nature because nature is so neat. So either out while you were camping or while you were working.
I do. It's one of my favorite memories of all time. It happened in April of 2017. And again, I have to give a bit of a backstory here. So I've been doing some long-term monitoring of the population of spotted turtles, partly for work, partly spare time, volunteering again. And it's an interesting study because it's following up on a previous study, which was begun in 1983, which is a long time ago. So I began my follow-up project in 1999, and I was able to find some of the turtles that had been marked in the first project in 1983. And I realized, if I keep this up long enough, I'm going to find some really old spotted turtles, and maybe I will get, quote unquote, the Guinness Book World Record for the oldest spotted turtle in the world. And in April of 2017, I was doing a survey with a couple of other biologists. We found this spotted turtle. I had my notebook, I checked my notes, and I just started jumping up and down, screaming, and they said, Dave, what's wrong? What's wrong? What's going on? And I said, I just almost started to cry. I said, this is the oldest known spotted turtle in the world, in the wild. So it was first marked in 1983 and had 17 growth lines, which are kind of like tree rings. And in 2017, that was 34 years later. So 34 plus 17 made 51. So it was at least 51 years old. The previous published record was something in the mid-30s. It had shattered the record. And in 2017, it still only had 17 growth lines. Because if you don't grow, you don't add new growth lines. So back in 1983, it may well have been a lot more than 17 years old. In fact, it almost certainly was. So this turtle is at least 51, but it could have been 61, maybe 71, who knows? So it was just an amazing experience to share this moment with a turtle over 50 years old.
That is so cool. I love spotted turtles. And it is one of the few species of turtles that I haven't seen in the wild yet in Canada. Wood turtle and spotted turtle. Those are the only two that I'm missing. So if you need any volunteers, let me know.
Unfortunately, they are both very rare and now endangered.
Mm-hmm. And if, I guess, next question for you would be, if you could wave a magic wand and have everyone adopt a new environmentally friendly habit, what would it be?
There's just so many to pick from, but I'll pick something outside the turtle field to be different, and it would have to be single-use plastics. It's just such a profound problem in the world. Straws and coffee cup lids to disposable coffee cups, especially, you know, again, pre-COVID days, and you're wandering around, it seems like everyone's got their disposable cup of coffee with their plastic coffee lid, and maybe they rinse it off and toss it in the recycling bin, but I think we know there's a lot of plastics which don't get recycled. Maybe it gets downcycled, and it just seems such a bizarre notion that we dig up oil, process it, ship it to a refinery, from there ship it to a factory, and then produce this thin little plastic layer to put on top of your coffee cup for maybe 20 minutes, at which point you then throw it in the garbage, and it's in a landfill for 500 years. There's something profoundly wrong with that.
And I don't know if I've ever heard someone put it that way. So I think that's a really great way of thinking about it. All this effort and energy that goes into a 20-minute maybe use. I have one other question for you. It's not on here, but if somebody sees a turtle on the side of the road, what should they do?
That's a great question, and thank you so much for asking. So first thing you should do is, if it's safe to do so, pull off the road, pull off onto the shoulder of the road, and then always take your own safety as point number one. So if it's a busy road, don't get killed trying to save a turtle. If the turtle is on the road and it's safe, you can look both ways, just like your mom told you, look both ways before crossing the road, pick up the turtle, move it across the road in the direction it's heading. So typically you can tell which way it's heading and move it that way. Now, for most species, it's very easy to pick a turtle up and move it off the road. The painted turtle is probably the most common species that people find on the road. They kind of have red on the margins of the shell. Easy to move. The worst thing that's going to happen is it might pee on you. And that may be not very much fun, but not a big deal. If it's a snapping turtle, that's a very different thing. And I would encourage you to check out our website, because we have a video on how to move a snapping turtle off the road. But if you just grab it, it may bite you because it does not realize what you're up to. And I do want to put a plug in for snapping turtles. Snapping turtles are not aggressive. Snapping turtles are defensive. If you're walking down a street and someone grabbed you, you would probably hit them and attack them, because not because you're aggressive, you're being defensive. So if you walk up and grab a snapping turtle, you are the aggressor. You may be trying to help it, but still you are the aggressor. So sometimes you can get a shovel or something and move a snapping turtle off the road, but it can be a tricky thing to move a snapper off the road. But they are amazing creatures and should not be feared or hated.
No, and I agree. I feel like if you're lucky enough to get close up to one, you get to see how cool they actually are. They're like dinosaurs. They are dinosaurs.
Indeed. And if you have a chance, you should always check out the tail of an adult snapping turtle. It's got spikes on the back of the tail, which really makes it look like a dinosaur.
And finally, if someone wanted to get involved with your organization or learn more about what you're doing, where should they go? What should they check out?
All right. So we've got a website for the Turtle Project called helptheturtles.ca. Very easy to remember, helptheturtles.ca. And I mentioned it's got the video on how to move a snapping turtle off the road. It's got some PDFs you can download, like how to build a nest protector. And you can also check out the main website for the Canadian Wildlife Federation. Just Google that and it will pop up in your feed.
Awesome. Well, we'll put all those links in our show notes in case somebody was driving or didn't have a piece of paper handy. But thank you so much, David, for sharing your time with us and all of your knowledge about turtles. I love turtles and I've loved this conversation.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
A huge thank you to David for sharing his knowledge and expertise with us. I know I will be keeping my eyes open for turtles when I am driving around this summer. And don't forget to like and subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss an episode. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to find out more about job opportunities and cool events. And next week, we sit down with a previous ELB board member and research advisor with the Greenbelt Foundation. All right, so here is a little fun geography fact to wrap up this episode. Regina, the capital city of Saskatchewan, is the geographical center of North America. Who knew? All right, that's all from me. Talk to you again next week. Happy trails.